Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Ruler podcast. My name's Jack Thurston, and this is the podcast for issue 54 of Ruler magazine. And you join me and Ian Cleverly, editor of the magazine, Andy McGrath, managing editor, and special guest on the podcast, unexpected guest, Jeff War, founding photographer, probably were. Were you in issue one, Jeff?
Oh, do you know what? I can't remember. I don't think I was.
You're certainly into single figures or top first five.
Early on. Yeah, I did some stuff in there. Again, I can't remember what it was, but I can remember the first issue, and I can remember that I don't have it anymore, and I wish that I had. Like a lot of other people that had the first issue. I think the pile of magazines by my chair got so big that my wife said that a colour was necessary, and that was one of the ones that went out.
Well, we're sitting outside Spin London, the urban bike show, where Jeff and I have been talking about cycling and photography. And Jeff, during your talk, you said that the whole style of photography of cycling had changed because of Ruler.
I think for people who have been shooting bikes for quite a few years, suddenly realised that there was more to it than a guy crossing the finish line with his arms in the air. And Ruler brought a whole new photojournalistic style to it that was more behind the scenes. And for guys that have been in it a long time, perhaps they didn't want to just read news reports, they want to read more meaty text, and it needed the images to go with it. And they were quite offbeat, you know, pictures of religious icons by the roadside, you know, things that we wouldn't really think of taking pictures of, that people have started to train their cameras on, which made me and hopefully others just look in other directions when they're photographing bike.
Right? But it's had an influence on photography beyond Ruler magazine.
Yeah,
so as the editorial team, how do you stay ahead if everyone's catching up with what Ruler was doing, you know, from 2007? Was it 2007 first issues?
2006, I think.
Yeah. So, you know, if Ruler changed cycling photography, and it's clearly had an influence on lots of other cycling magazines that will remain nameless for now, how do you keep the advantage?
It's a extremely good question, and quite timely. I received two emails from photographers this week saying, "Hey, I took this great gallery from inside a team car at a race, and it's so exciting because that's the first time they've ever done it." And I just looked at it and I thought, "Yeah, it's very nice, but you know, we've been doing that for a few years now. It's kind of like, where do you go next?" So I guess that's what we have to work out.
But sometimes I kind of quite like receiving portfolios from photographers who don't have a background in cycling, are a very good quality, and yet have a good knowledge of the sport, and they kind of sometimes bring a different eye, and it's kind of it is more original sometimes if they haven't been published elsewhere in the cycling media, and that can be quite nice. But it's hard finding the right combination of that implicit knowledge of the bike race, where you have to be at the right moment, is actually really hard. Same for a journalist too.
To take a combative debating position, do you think that those images of the rider's foot in the corner of the frame and then an old lady holding a couple of bags, or the religious icon by the side of the road, those end up becoming the rider holding his arms aloft, you know, after a while? It's, you know, almost a decade, isn't it, that style of photography has really sort of swamped cycling.
Yeah, I think
where's the next stage?
Well, some of it, I don't know about the next stage, but some of it, you know, Ruler's published series by Magnum photographers that I'd never seen before, and they are obviously not cycling photographers, and they've done things that really, really get me going. You know, part of it's nostalgic, obviously, but they bring such a great vision to their subject. And I think it'll be down to the photographers. It'll be how they see it in the future, how they decide to do it, to bring a new style to the photography. You know, what annoys me is when people say, "Yeah, but look, you know that shoe in the corner of the frame, I could have done that." But actually, the deeper you look, the more you realise, no, you couldn't have done that, because you've got to see it first, and then you've got to put it in the whole context of the feature, or you know, whatever you're shooting for.
I thought that really struck me listening to your talk when you were explaining the photos that you'd taken, and the one of Paris-Roubaix where you're standing in a ditch and waiting for somebody to wave a flag at just the right moment in order to cover the sun, yeah, which otherwise would have been blowing out the photo.
Yeah.
I just thought that was, you know, that's a perfect indication of your art and the way you see things, well, that the rest of us just don't kind of quite have, sadly.
And but that's quite a technical thing as well. You know, I need that. I haven't got an assistant who can flag out the sun for me, but there's a guy with a Belgian flag, you know, and it in itself, it tells the story of being there, you know, with the colours. You know, everyone likes to see those colours by the roadside, it seems, you know.
Well, that brings us very neatly to our traditional opening of the podcast, which is to pick a memorable or favourite photograph from the magazine. Andy, do you want to have a first pick?
Yeah, I'll kick off with one on page 82 of Francesco Moser in full flight in an 84... from the 84 Giro, and it isn't just the kind of, you can see how fast he's going and how strong he looks, it's really the faces of the fans, and you can tell they're Moser fans, not Cerrone fans, because they're going absolutely mad. You've got Vineyards too, it's very Italian, and it kind of sums up that era perfectly for me. It's a face of a little kid, kind of completely level with Moser, which is just fantastic. Like, that's pure joy, that's what you want to see from kids of bike racers. That's kind of,
oh, this little kid here. Well, that's what Jeff. That's perfect rule of thirds, isn't it? There, little boy there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
you were talking about the rule of thirds to all us amateur photographers in the talk. Then
whether that's on purpose or not, I can't tell. But yeah, the thing is it's perfectly placed in that bottom left hand third where you can see, and he's got such a great face as well. You know, from where I am, he's almost crying with excitement, isn't he? Yeah. It's fantastic. He's got trainers on, dusty trainers and knee-high socks. Perfect.
It's only mid-80s.
Yeah.
Jeff, what's your pick?
Mine is here, and it's Cerrone. I'll just get to the page. Where are we? 80. This one, fantastic. And I like this because it looks like a picture.
This is 81, page 81.
Page 81, and it's Cerrone at the start of the 86 Giro. And it actually looks like a picture that he'd sent to his mum. Or you know, it's a snapshot, and he looks so suave. You know, his hair looks perfect, not hair out of place. He's got the pink jersey on.
It's sort of the Brian Ferry of the cycling world.
It does look
it?
A bit like that, doesn't it? Yeah. You know, he's bronze. I mean, it couldn't be more Italian if it tried. You know, you could actually imagine that he'd just sneak off somewhere just to chat up some ladies rather than race. Yeah. You know, it's fantastic.
If he hadn't been a pro cyclist, he'd be in a Fellini film.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, you know that he's got the best suit in the peloton as well, you know, when he goes out to church on a Sunday or whatever he does, you know. And the background as well, this guy here with the red cap, you know, perfectly. He's got the luft, is it called? The luft on his cap's perfect, you know, very casual, very super Italian, the architecture behind him. But he looks so suave. That's what I like about that shot, yeah.
Frankly, if he wasn't in Lycra, he could be a mafia boss, I think.
Yeah,
it's that kind of face. He reminds me of Andy Garcia a bit, and De Niro a little bit.
He's got that look that sort of says, yeah, I'm a nice guy, you know, but you could have concrete shoes on if you cross me, you know.
Ian?
Bit of an unusual one for me, because I'm going for the subscriber cover shot. Which is actually an illustration, but it is a photograph by Graham Brown of a Peace Race board game cover. And it was a bit of an odd one for Graham to go and shoot, because he just sort of said, hey, I'm going to Barcelona, do you want to do anything? So we said, well, drop in on this guy and shoot his collection of cycling board games. And it's just such a beautiful, beautiful illustration, so, and just it perfectly embodies the peace race and that kind of era of graphics. Lovely.
Yeah. No, it's, I mean, certainly a lot of great graphics came out of the peace race. Have you still got copies of those posters? Are those sold out now, the prints?
I think they're long gone.
Long gone.
Yeah, they were beautiful. Absolutely. That was Herbie Sykes dug those up. Good work.
So my choice is from Andy's feature on Giorgia Bronzini. And where is it? Okay, yeah. So this is double page spread on page 126-27. And it's a great sort of race photograph. There she is in the middle, a little bit on the page fold there, but if you sort of press it out and you can catch it. And then what you won't spot immediately, but which is extraordinary, is that she's actually got what looks like a can of beer in her hand, in her left hand, her tattooed hand. I mean, they've all got tats, these the women that we can see in the front of the race. One of them's pulling on Georgia's back pocket there. And then, yeah, she's got this beer. So what's the story here? I mean, this is during a race, right?
It is during a race. Yeah, I mean, fascinating. I love the fact that I have no idea what the story is, and the woman who's pulling on her pocket has obviously spotted the can of beer and fancies a swig. And
maybe she's got cigarettes in there. She wants a beer and a fag.
Yeah. No, love it.
Any ideas, Andy? What's going on here? Did you call her up and ask her?
Not yet, I really should. I mean, to be perfectly honest, I didn't see it until yesterday, and it's been out for 4 weeks, and we were kind of producing the magazine. But my eye was always drawn to the woman holding on to her pocket. I'm guessing it's a Giro, it's Final Mountain, they're knackered. Let's have a beer, have a bit of fun.
Well, it seems to sum up the woman a little bit, that a kind of someone who makes their own journey in life, which I thought was a nice. It's always nice when a photograph works with the feature. So, should we talk about Giorgia Bronzini? We've got competition business to deal with, haven't we? We've got competition.
Do you get the competition?
Competition business.
The winner.
Winner from the previous one, which would have been issue 53, because the question was who introduced the organisers to the Arenberg. For Paris-Roubaix, and it was, of course, Jean Stablinski. And the winner was Michael Taylor, and he won a Mavic Cosmic jacket, courtesy of Condor Cycles.
Congratulations, Michael. Has he received it by now? Probably has, hasn't he?
I believe so. He's probably do with it today. It's not exactly warm, is it?
Well, we have another competition towards the end, won't we? So cyclocross orientated. Yes. So stay tuned for that. But let's get to Giorgia Bronzini. This is your piece from the words perspective, Andy. What a great character.
Yeah, it doesn't really come across so much in the interview, but she's very bubbly. She's very fun. She's laughing a lot. So, I mean, it's quite a serious interview, I think, in some places, but she's incredibly fun. And she's never conformed to that kind of, I think, like in pro cycling, conformity is very important, and a lot of riders feel they have to fit in, and that kind of stops them from making certain choices. But she's always asked questions, and she's kind of changed Italian women's cycling, I think, for the better. There are some quite revealing things she was saying about the Italian women's manager not wanting to work with women's staff, which is strange, because he's also her coach and one of her best friends. But she didn't get past that.
It does sound like the Italian Federation is a bit dysfunctional, or at least the team. I don't know whether it was the team that she was... I couldn't work out whether it was the team that she was on or the Italian National Federation, or whether there was a sort of bit of overlap between them. But it does seem like she needed to get out of Italy, and she wasn't the only one.
That's the thing. Well, she led the way. I think it was more the kind of professional teams, and I'll say professional in inverted commas, because they were a bit of a mess, frankly. And she realised she could get more money, she could have a better career. And this is kind of at the age of 28, a few years ago. I think she's quite underrated. I mean, she's won two world titles. I think she's won at least one race every year. She's been among the best for the last 10 years, and that kind of longevity isn't often appreciated. Everyone looks at Marianne Vos, and not only is Bronzini just as fast as her, she's arguably much more interesting, fun, and she's got a perspective she isn't afraid to share, as we see in the interview.
And so you met her down at the Tour of Britain?
Yes.
Yeah, down in Kent, was it?
Kettering.
Kettering in North Hants. Did you get any sense from her and the other riders what they thought of the race?
This was kind of before the race, the debut race last year. But I think, I mean, I wasn't at the race last year, but from what I've heard, it was fantastic. That was a breath of fresh air. And hopefully that will continue this year, because it's starting in 3 or 4 weeks. Is it next month, the women's tour?
Hasn't the date moved? I thought it had gone back slightly. But the overwhelming feedback from that inaugural race was knocked out by the crowds as much as anything. Just you know, women's racing is not used to having such huge crowds. And it showed straight away that there is an appetite for it.
It does seem all the problems that women's racing faces in relation to money, principally, and status, and I guess they're related. But it does seem that the sport has the opportunity to forge a slight, you know, it's not so weighed down by the past, maybe, and the problems of the past, and the weight of past races dealing with existing structures. There's an opportunity to be a bit more fleet-footed and to create new and interesting stuff, which there's a lot more, in a way, that's up for grabs.
I think Mick Bennett and Sweet Spot showed that by putting the tour on last year, you know, just putting it out there and as a... I mean, it's quite a big punt, and it showed if you do it right, you do it well, it can come off. But an interesting comment from Simon Burney, and this is related to the interview with Helen Wyman that will be on the end of this podcast. When he was saying that coming from a mountain biking background, was that mountain biking was equal for men and women from the word go, because it was ground zero. It started from nowhere. Cycling has these hundreds of years of history, and therefore women have been on the catch up. You know, it's a relatively recent thing. When was the first women's world championships?
Late '70s, early '80s.
Really?
Ridiculous.
No, actually, I was thinking of the '90s. I was thinking of cyclocross. It was something like 90.
Whereas the Olympics was 1984. I think was the women's cycling in the Olympics. I mean, I guess there's a dilemma about whether you want to create a parallel and equal strand of women's cycling alongside all the great men's races, or whether you want to set up a whole new edifice that's built in 2015 or whatever, rather than what was built in 1906. And that must be a dilemma a little bit, whether you're just going to have a women's Paris-Roubaix, women's Tour de France in parallel, or whether you're going to start having different races.
Women's cycling, to me, seems to be pretty much split down the middle on that. Is that half the people involved in it say it's fantastic to be at the men's race and to have, you know, the big crowds and the atmosphere, and there's the other half saying no, we actually need to be totally separate and to stand on our own 2 feet. So that's a dilemma. I'm not sure which is the best.
I think it should never be tokenist. That's a problem. That's the kind of area you're encroaching on sometimes. When you say there should be a women's race with a men's race, it's got to be for the right values and the right reasons. That's the important thing. I just hope it improves over the next 5-10 years, because it seems to be taking kind of one step forward and then 2 steps back. Every so often we have this kind of call to arms from women racers, and then it kind of dies down again. So it needs to be a kind of blanket improvement rather than just like pockets, like in the UK and things like that.
Jeff, do you ever get sent off to photograph women's races?
Yeah, I did the tour last year for Ruleur. From a purely selfish point of view, it was great because I didn't have to stay over anywhere. I could actually drive from my house to the start of every stage. You know, it's tremendous. And it was actually really nice to work on. Pretty relaxed, you know, great racing. I would say internationally, and again from purely a photographer's point of view, we can shoot both races on the same day sometimes, you know, which is fine, you know.
Double the work.
Yeah, well, it's double the work, but it also means, you know, you don't have to go back again, sort of thing. So in that respect, it's quite good. I'm looking forward to this year as well, because, again, it's sort of loosely based around around my town, and also where it went out last year to Clacton, I think, and Felix, though. That's sort of my old manor, you know, where I came from. So that was quite nice to revisit the old haunt. Sort of.
So you know where all the wizened old trees are and all the little ponds of water where you can get the reflections in and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, on Frinton Seafront. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I know the roads fairly well out there, and it's just nice to be back there and you know, see what hadn't changed. Yeah.
Well, we'll hear more from Helen Wyman at the Q&A following the screening of For the Love of Mud, the cyclocross film, which is the subject of our competition. But before that, Ian, carbon wheels. You've been to find out about a lot of technical stuff that was already over my head in sort of paragraph two.
Oh no, I failed then, Jack. I failed. I tried my hardest to keep it in layman's terms, because I don't understand lift and drag as well.
I think you did the lift and drag quite well, but it was the woven carbon versus the unidirectional carbon.
Yeah. No, well, your unidirectional carbon, Jack. Yeah. That's what Paul Lou says in the piece. And Paul Lou is the design man at Reynolds, and is actually a bit of a legend in the wheel making business, and not to mention, you know, several other crazy things that he makes, like car bumpers and drones. Believe it or not, that's his other business. He said that when he'd gone to Rolf of Rolf Wheels, and he was just doing wheels for him, and Rolf was going, well, these are great, but they're could you make them out of carbon? And he said, well, this is carbon. He says, yeah, but it doesn't look like carbon. And you know, if you're going to spend a lot of money on a pair of flashy wheels, you kind of want them to look like, you want people to look at them and go, nice carbon wheels. But they got around it now.
Fascinating story of innovation. This guy sounds like he's got a thousand ideas in his brain bubbling away, and he thinks that everyone who's spending all that expensive time in wind tunnels has got it wrong.
He does, and a lot of people seem to agree with him. It's interesting when I go to other manufacturers. I say, hey, Paul Lou says that you're doing your wind testing wrong, and they go, well, yeah, I've got a lot of respect for Paul Lou, but, you know, this is the standard. The standard is that you test at 50 kilometres an hour at certain degrees, yaw, and these are the results that everybody publishes. But you know, as Paul Lou says, well, who rides in a 50 kilometre an hour wind? Nobody. You'd hardly be going forward. So in that respect, it doesn't add up, and that's why he designs for real life conditions. And he says a lot of people aren't.
And so his sort of take home message was that the really skinny bikes were better than the sort of fat and supposedly really aero from a wind tunnel perspective bikes, because essentially those fat bikes are not fat bikes in the mountain biking sense of the word fat, but you know, the super fluid aero frames are creating a lot of lift, which forward thrust, but that is purely a function of what happens in a wind tunnel when you're getting a 12 degree wind, which is very unrepresentative of normal conditions. So they're basically optimizing the design for a totally unrealistic scenario.
You said a minute ago you didn't understand anything.
I understood that bit.
You've just perfectly summarised it. Oh no, that was the bit you did understand.
I didn't. Yeah, it was very well explained. Cyclocross. You hosted a screening. Was it the premiere of For the Love of Mud?
It was the London premiere. Okay. At the Barbican, which was great fun and very good film by Mr. Benedict Campbell, and had a nice little Q&A at the end with Helen Wyman and Benedict himself. Which one else?
Yeah, so that's a full-length feature film about cyclocross that I haven't seen it myself, but I have listened to the recording of the Q&A, and from what I gleaned from it, that it covers the history of the discipline as well as you know, what's going on right now.
Yeah, actually, the subtitle of the film is An Introduction to Cyclocross, which I think is actually a good description and a good way of going about it, because otherwise, if you make a film about cyclocross per se, you're just preaching to the converted. The idea of his film is to explain it, what it is, the people who do it, why they love it,
and he's done a good job.
Did you see their film, Jeff?
I was there, yeah. I saw it. Fantastic. Loved it. Yeah, yeah.
Because they used some of your footage, didn't it?
No. Basically, when I made a short about the Three Peaks, and Benedict got in touch just to ask about the various places which were accessible and good to film, and then he went up there and trumped me, really, with his superior techniques. It was really, really good. Very good. Because he went to the States a lot, where they're a slightly different take to us, a bit rowdier, you know, more cowbells. Excellent.
And you can win a copy of a DVD of the film, right? And in the Ruler podcast competition this time.
Yes, prizes a DVD of For the Love of Mud and a matching casquette as well. Rather lovely. If you answer the very simple question, how many times has Helen Wyman been national cyclocross champion?
Okay, so how many times has Helen Wyman been national cyclocross champion? Answers to competitions?
I think it's singular. competition@ruler.cc.
Okay, send in those answers to be in with a chance to win a DVD and casquette of For the Love of Mud. And we're going to play out with some edited highlights, which is predominantly Helen Wyman. Not because she was the only one who said anything interesting, but a lot of the rest of the conversation in the Q&A was specifically about the film. And if you've not seen the film, then it doesn't make quite so much sense. So that's it for this time, isn't it? On with the Giro, back to the hipsters in Spin London. Yeah.
I'm going to grow a beard before I go back in. I don't want to fit in.
I can't, I'm too young. Bit of bum fluff, maybe.
Yeah, I've got no chance. Look at me.
Well, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Cheers.
The inexorable rise of cycling in this country, to my mind, cross seems to have got somewhat left behind. Does that ring true with you? And if so, how do we grow it? And obviously your film's a good start. We need to get people to see this, but...
Yeah, well, that's why I made a thing about the Supercross. The American, it's growing so quickly over there because they know how to have fun.
Mm.
The end of, they really know how to put on a good, fun race. And that's what the cross races need to be. They need to be more entertaining to attract more people. I mean, one question I'll put out is, so can you put your hand up if you've never raced a cross race in this room? Okay, oh, wow. Right. Now put your hand, keep them up. Now put them down if you're still never going to race a cross race after watching the film. So the ones up, ooh, that's pretty good. See,
that's
kind of what the film is to do, is to try and to show you what a great world it is and how fun it is.
I think when we get the opportunity to showcase our sport, we do a really good job. And the Milton Keynes World Cup was one of the best World Cups.
Yeah.
And you know, we had over 10,000 people attended that event, and only 9,000 went to Coxsider. So it's not that the sport isn't big when you give people the opportunity to showcase it, it's just that maybe the opportunities aren't there unless there's someone driving it. So yeah, I know Richard wants to do another World Cup in the future, they can't this year, but you know, maybe that's how you drive it, by you inspire people there. And that was one of the best World Cups for me, because the crowd were just so crazy loud, and it was just truly emotional. And you saw Ian, I know he's weak, but he cried on the podium. And it's like, it really felt like that, you know. And that, and it must have felt similar for the people spectating, because it was just in a fantastic atmosphere. And maybe that's how you grow the sport, by giving them top quality events that they can come and support.
But is there also maybe an element, and I'm just throwing this out there, that you have to be sort of careful what you wish for, in so much as who is it? Ben Burden said it's great. It's like a little family that you see every weekend moving around, and you probably get it because you're
in America.
Europe,
it's
you're seeing the same bunch of people every weekend, just maybe with a few fans thrown in.
Depends on
but you know
family.
What I'm saying? It's like that level of success. Does the sport get to a point where you actually kind of think, actually, this isn't my sport anymore? Maybe I'll go and find something weirder to go and do. Because isn't that part of the appeal in the first place? Yeah, it's maybe. Weird. It's weird. I don't want to be normal.
Yeah, maybe. I think in I'm encased in the Belgian situation, and in Belgium, it's perfectly normal to ride a cross bike.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
perfectly normal. It's like, you know, Sven Nys has been Sportsman of the Year multiple times, so it's not, you know, it's not weird over there. But in other countries, so in England, in America, it's very much about the fans, and it's about participation, and it's about everybody enjoying it and having a lot more fun. And the two courses are going very separate ways, and both work. So it's not that, you know, it's not that Belgium's got it right or that America and England have got it right, but the two just don't mix very well. But yeah,
very interesting comment from Simon Burney there, saying coming from an empty mountain bike background where it just started, you know, there's no question of it. Yeah, it's equality from the word go, and that about how the women are playing catch up. It's, I mean, you're part and parcel of that, trying to catch us up.
Yeah.
How's it going? I mean, do you have to go to the UCI, sort of bang your fist on the table and go to sort of internal meetings?
Yeah.
I think you might quite be quite good at that somehow.
I thought I was better than I obviously am. It was going good. It was going really good. We got our race times moved to the right time. We got equal prize money for C2s. We got equal parking, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it means you get better media coverage and things. I managed to get equal prize money for a C1 at Koppenberg last year by getting an American sponsor in. But then it's like banging your head against a brick wall when it comes to World Cup prize money and to progressing the sport further, for because we only do 40 minutes at the minute, and now it's a minimum of 40 minutes, but I want 50 minutes and then I want an hour, and that's an impossible task, and it's currently frustrating.
why is it so difficult? Who's standing in, are we talking about guys with totally ridiculous old-fashioned attitudes who refuse to change?
No, it's not that anyone disagrees that it's unfair, because at the minute the World Cup first place for a man is €5,000 per round, and for a woman it's 1,000. And then for 11th place is €220, and for the 50th place man, bearing in mind that most World Cups there's between 45 and 50 finishes,
yeah,
and 50th is 6 laps down, gets €300.
Mm.
So to me, that's outrageous. And everyone on the committee agrees it's wrong. But every single proposal I've put to them, they have blatantly refused. So it's, they don't want to take from the men to give to the women, but how do you find a deficit of €33,000 per round?
Yeah.
Where do you find that?
Yeah.
One of the things that you've mentioned is the growth of the sport in the UK. I race very occasionally, or go around in circles in the field at least, and really enjoy it. I think it's something that I've noticed my friends have definitely taken up in the last couple of years a lot more, so I think it's becoming popular. I just wondered your thoughts on the use of social media, particularly around it, because I know, Helen, you and I have actually talked on social media a fair bit, and you're very good on that format, and I just wonder what your thoughts are on that as a way to encourage participation in the sport and to kind of articulate what the sport's about.
I mean for me it's a lot more important to be able to use social media. Women's cycling has developed a lot quicker because of the use of social media, and we kind of know how to do return. But I think to grow the sport in the UK, you probably need to show that there are top riders up there that are able to make a living out of it. And for the young kids coming through, if they don't have a Sven Nys to look at from their country, they don't necessarily see how they come from 14 to him. And so that in that case, social media is a really, really important role for that, because everybody's on Facebook and Twitter and all those things. And I genuinely think that it's possible to make a career out of it. And the two young girls coming through at the minute, Amira Mella and Hannah Payton, we set up a GoFund page for them to try and get them some funding to get to the American World Cups, because there's no actual funding for them. And within 10 days, they'd made their £1,500 target. So, you know, I do think that by encouraging the younger riders that to stay in the sport, you create something at the top that people can aspire to, but at the bottom you still need to grow people that don't necessarily want to be the next world champion but just want to ride their bike for fun, and that way you do it through showing people that it's a family day out, it's safe, it's, you know, kids can come and just play around with their friends and ride around all over the place because they're in a contained venue and they can't get out. And, you know, when every race in America is just genuinely, there's just kids everywhere, not on the course, but just everywhere. And the family there, and the mum's raced and the dad's raced, and they're all staying to watch all the rest of it. And to me, that's how you grow it, because they then tell their friends and they're sat under their little tents having beer and trying to do hand-ups and all that kind of thing. And they tell their friends and their friends come along and they bring their families, and that's how it grows at the bottom of the pyramid. And to me, that's how you make cross bigger. But in terms of at the top, I think you need someone, you need role models for people to know that I was just a kid that started racing in the Eastern League and, you know, now I'm second in the world. So.
Anything to add, Bennett?
Yeah, well, same really. That's why I had a few the Americans saying, "Well, what's with the Ben Sumner? Why is he in the film?" You know, and I said that he's just to illustrate that you go from being just a local kid that does really well to riding for your country and becoming like a neo pro. And it's just to show that there is something that you can achieve, you know, in that sense, that you can go up. But the sport really, you know, we keep saying it makes you smile, but it really does light people up, like any more than any other cycle racing there is. And you just have to coax friends along, you know, it doesn't matter, just to go round a few laps and just show them how much fun.
Something they do in America as well that we don't do in this country are actual cross clinics.
Yeah.
And I run cross clinic at a midnight ride, which is a night race, evening night race. And we have about 40 people over the 2 days. And we actually have the venue to train on, so we can practice the course and ride. And on the cross clinic every year, we have maybe 10 or 15 people that have never raced a bike, never raced a cross bike before. And that's their first event. And so they come to the clinic and they learn a little bit about it and get to practice the course and then race. And every year you go back, you get the same people coming back. And every year it grows, because those people thought it was fantastic the first year, want to learn more skills now they've had a year of racing and things. And then it moves on from there. And then they tell their friends, and their friends are the newbies that were them the year before, you know.
Yeah.
And maybe that's something that the UK needs more of. Things like Milton Keynes World Cup to provide that opportunity, because you've created a venue, you've got a fantastic venue that made an amazing race, and all of the best riders in the world were there on that day. So if you introduce people to the sport, you know, maybe, I don't know if people that play football go and watch football. I'm not really sure if the same percentage works, but if that's the case, if you play football and you still go and watch your favourite team, then why would you not go to a World Cup, see the best riders in the world and be further inspired from there to do that? And again, through social media, to use social media for people to see that there is something else out there. And the UCI are trying to do things with, like, the YouTube channel. They have a cyclocross YouTube channel where they show the World Cups and everything. But you have to be interested in the sport in the first place to actually go search for that. And you can watch every race in Belgium on live feed now, I think, most races. And again, you have to know that to go look for it. But maybe by introducing people into it, they'd then start looking further into it, maybe.
I have a question, but just to let you know as well, I started cyclocross this season off the back of a clinic. So
good work.
It is happening. Well, yeah. And I'm currently trying to recruit Libby here to join me.
Excellent.
Next season.
You should, Libby.
very quick question, because I know it's getting on. Was there a trigger moment that inspired you to write that open letter?
Yes, there was, actually. There's a young kid in the UK called Daniel Tullett, and he is incredibly good. He won the support race at Coxsider World Cup. He's national champion. And he... how do I put this politically correct? The system of British cycling is fantastic. Wouldn't knock it. It's created Olympic and world champions. It's a fantastic system. But when a rider becomes incredibly good at cyclocross, they want him for mountain biking, or they want him for road, or they want him for something else. Because if a kid's talented, they're talented, and you can turn them into anything you want them to be. So his options were the best professional cyclocross teams in the world, who would pick him up, 16 years old, and develop him into the next Niels Albert, Sven Nys, you know. Or he could go down the Olympic route of mountain biking, of the Olympic development program. And my letter was written to say to riders like him and other riders, look, guys, it's 2015. This sport is financially very, very good for men. It's good for women, but it's incredibly good for men. And there's no reason in the world why you can't ride cross for 6 or 7 years from when you're 16, and then you do what Lars Boom has done, or you do what Stuyvesant's done, or any of the other riders that have come through, won junior, under 23, elite worlds, and then gone to road. And you're not tired because you don't have to train for as long, so your body's not as tired, and your races are a lot shorter, and you pick up less injuries, and so... because there's less of you, you're helped a lot better. You're not just used and abused tool, because there's not another one to replace you. And he's the biggest talent I've seen in cyclocross since Roger Hammond. So, and he was junior world champion. So there's no reason why that kid shouldn't follow the path of cross, and he loves it. And so I just wanted to say, you know, guys, if you love it, do it, and put your work in now, and put a few sacrifices in now, but you can have fantastic rewards. And my life is great, honestly. I trained as a physio. I worked in the NHS for 2 years, and I would not change a single day since that day I left. And I hopefully, you know, Kona will keep paying me for another 10 years. But
okay, well, if everyone's in agreement, I think we'll say thank you very much to Helen and Benedict, and good night. Thank you, Helen and Benedict.
Thanks for downloading this edition of the Ruler podcast. You can read Ruler magazine, which comes out 8 times a year, by taking out a subscription. Go to www.ruler.cc, or you can pick up the latest edition at a growing number of bookshops and bike shops. If you've got an iPad, you can read the magazine on the iPad. Not only the current issue, but a handful of back issues as well. You'll find it in the Apple Bookstore.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.